Welcome to the Merlin Capital July 2017 teleconference. Today's call involves a 25-minute presentation followed by a 5-minute Q&A session, during which time you can press star 1 on your telephone keypad to ask a question. Your host today is Nathan Burrows of Fidante Partners. Over to you, Nathan.
Thank you, Kelly, and thank you also to everyone for dialing in today. On behalf of Fidante Partners, I'd like to introduce both Neil Margolis, Lead Portfolio Manager, and Adrian Lemmy, Portfolio Manager for Merlon Capital. Good morning, guys.
Morning.
Neil and Adrian will be giving us an update on their Australian Share Income Fund, whilst also touching on both the impact of Amazon on the Australian market and looking at value investing from an Australian perspective. Before I hand over to the guys, just a quick reminder that an email will follow today's presentation with your CPD points attached, so please keep an eye out for that. And I'll now pass over to Neil and Adrian. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Nathan. It's Adrian here. Good morning, everyone. And firstly, just on the first slide in the pack, just wanted to briefly recap how Merlon is different. Yes, the fund's monthly income has been the same or higher for 60 months, but it is an outcome of our approach, not the target. The vast majority of our time is spent on fundamental research, focused on identifying undervalued companies based on sustainable free cash flow. Then we construct a portfolio based on the best ranked ideas without reference to skewed index weights. And the hedge overlay is separately applied, allowing investors to benefit from the high franked income and outperformance of the underlying share portfolio, with 30% less risk than the market and other share funds. So with that, I'll move on to slide 5, where, this is the detailed report on Amazon. And I'm very excited to present this today because I feel like almost every day you're seeing news articles in the media about how Amazon is going to destroy the retailers here. And I think a lot of it is over the top, and I'm just trying to present a different view on it and a more balanced opinion. Now, firstly, don't misunderstand us. We do believe that Amazon will take market share here and impact retailer profit margins. And we outline why on page 8 of the actual quarterly report, where we discuss the clear competitive advantages that Amazon has and the impact it will have on the industry structure of retailing. And the main thing is really that Amazon Prime, the subscription model where you get bundled online video streaming and free 1 or 2 day delivery on a large range of items is a clear competitive advantage, and that's going to be the biggest impact for the retailers here. And if you look at the North American experience, in North America, which is mostly the US, their sales grew by 25% in 2016 to $80 billion. So, you know, it's clear why the news articles are pushing Amazon. But the point of the article is really to highlight some key differences between Australia and the other markets. And so from that, we suggest that there's a lot of bad news priced into the sector, and so there's some good opportunities here. Now, on slide 5, first I want to present some context about online retailing in Australia. And the key point from the chart is that online retail is actually maturing. So the blue line is the growth in non-food online retail sales, and I compare this to non-food retail sales overall. And you can see that it has been growing faster than general retailing, but that growth has slowed a lot from, say, 30% prior to the last few years, and it's down to 13% in 2016. And in fact, the recent data in the last few months has had it down to as low as 7%. So you could ask, why has it been slowing? I mean, obviously, it's the law of large numbers, but also I think the currency has had a large impact on this. So when the currency was at parity with the US dollar or in the 90s, there was a strong price incentive to order from international sources, be it Amazon or wherever else. But a lot of that incentive has gone now with the currency sort of in the 70s. And I know this personally myself, being a stronger buyer online. Now, no doubt the growth will pick up when Amazon starts up. You're gonna see, like, if you think of the reporting that we've seen on Audi since it started, just think of it on a grander scale. So there's going to be lots of media articles pushing Amazon as being, you know, a great place to buy. There'll be a lot of media puff pieces, but yeah. So anyway, moving to slide 6, This is, I think, the best chart in the whole report. What we do here is we've looked at Canada, the US and the UK as comparable markets to Australia. And the reason is because Amazon's been in these markets for well over a decade. So we're trying to learn, you know, from their experience what the impact might be in Australia. And the key thing to note here is that we think population density has a strong relationship to the success of online in a country. And if you look at it, we've taken the log of it because UK's population density is literally off the charts. But when you take the log of it, it's clear that the UK at 22% online retail sales penetration is associated with a high population density. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got Australia and Canada, who are much lower. Now, that Canada numbers, it's worth pointing out that the Canadian statistics, which we've sourced the data from for online sales, doesn't include international online sales. And of course, Canada bordering on the US, there is a lot of buying that happens from US online retailers. So if you adjusted for that, I think the online penetration for Canada is probably in line or slightly above Australia. So that relationship holds. And there's logic to why population density is important, because obviously the more dense an area, the cheaper and quicker it is to deliver a good in say a street, because there'll be many other orders in the same sort of area. So it makes it more economic for an Amazon or whoever else to fulfill the order. Now, a common refrain that you'll hear about the Canadian argument is, well, Australia's East Coast is actually very dense. But this is no different to Canada, where if you think of the southern border, where all the major cities are, they also have very high density. So it's just that the country overall is not very dense. Whereas if you look at the UK, if you looked at a map of density, the whole chart is red. The whole place is dense. So that's the key difference. Now, if you link it back to Amazon's experience in Canada, we've reviewed their segmental disclosures because they don't actually give you Canada, but you can sort of back it out. And we think at most they're doing US $2 billion of sales in Canada. We've actually verified that with another source in the last few days, which is actually less than 1% of the total Canadian retail market. Now, if you compare this to their US sales, which we estimate are somewhere in the high 70s, say $78 billion, like even if you account for the differences in population, it's clear that Amazon has been nowhere near as successful in Canada, and they've admitted as such privately. The other thing to note that we've learned in the last few days since we put the report out is that Amazon's Canadian sales, we hear, are only growing by 15% currently, and that's actually below the growth of the total Canadian online market. So it's clear that they're not hitting it out of the park, and we've also learned that in France, they've also got a similar level of market share and growth. One of the challenges in Canada has been delivery, and we understand that Amazon relies on Canada Post in that market. And we think the same is going to happen here. We understand Australia Post is in active discussions with Amazon on fulfillment. So from that perspective, again, there's no real advantage for Amazon there. Any other retailer can use Australia Post here already is. So they're going to have to come up, and not to say they won't, but they'll have to come up with some creative ways of overcoming the limitations in Australia. Now, one other point, which I think I mentioned a while ago, but we've sort of dug into a bit more detail, is the tax arbitrage that Amazon enjoyed for many years in the US. And that won't be repeated here. So just to recap, in the US, for many years, Amazon was only collecting sales tax in a handful of states. And these sales taxes are both state and local, and they add up to something like 7 to 10% of the price of a good. And that was because they didn't have a physical presence, i.e. a fulfillment center in that market. But of course, in Australia, they're not going to get that benefit. They're going to be collecting the 10% GST just like any other retailer. And, you know, in speaking to people, they have acknowledged that at least in the early days, that price advantage was of huge benefit to Amazon. So just to recap there, it's clear that there are some differences to the US market, and we think Australia is more like Canada. Moving to slide 7, what does it mean for the listed retailers? This chart here plots what we think is important. This is on the x-axis, the gross margin of the retailer versus the cost of doing business sales, so essentially the operating cost structure of the retailer. And we think the stocks that are at most at risk on this measure are the ones that have high gross margin and high costs. So from the chart, you can clearly see that JB Hi-Fi is very well placed because they have the lowest margins of this group and the lowest cost of doing business to sales. And we actually think it's hard to ascertain this from Amazon's accounts in the last few years, but we think that their cost structure and their gross margin is in line or slightly better than Amazon's. So they're well placed. And on the other hand, Myer, Big W, Super Retail, just to name a few, you know, they obviously have higher gross margins, higher cost of doing business to sales, which is, would be higher than Amazon in retailing. So we think, you know, they have some challenges there that they have to address. One thing to note, Premier there is the highest on both those measures, but it's important to recognise that it through its own brand, it sells its own products. So it's different to the other retailers. And in particular, Smiggle and Peter Alexander brands are quite well differentiated. So we're not sort of calling them out as hugely at risk. From a category perspective, we think online retailers, in particular, say, an eBay and department stores are most at risk of Amazon. If you think of eBay alone, they do something like $3 to $5 billion of sales here through their third-party marketplace, and that is what is most comparable to Amazon. Department stores, if you look at in the US, the category has been contracting for the last decade. You've seen a ramp up in store closures from the likes of Macy's, Sears, etc. And we also call out Kmart in this respect. Although Kmart, you know, looks good at the moment, it's got very high margins, and the cost of its goods are actually quite low, which, if everything goes to free delivery, actually presents a challenge for them. Supermarkets, we think, should be okay. If you look at Amazon's recent acquisition of Whole Foods in the US, which has gotten a lot of press, we think it's evidence that Amazon Fresh will be a premium rather than price-led proposition. So this plays into the strengths of Woolies and Coles with its large network of bricks and mortar stores and its growing online capability. And one last comment on REITs. I would just say that I think they will be impacted, and I don't think it's fully priced into those stocks. If you look at a specialty retailer who's selling in a Westfield, their rent to sales would be something like 25% or higher in some instances, and that alone would be a higher cost of doing business than Amazon. So that's, you know, aside from wages and all the other costs. So we think that REITs will need to lower rents over time, and we don't think it's fully priced in. So moving on to slide 8, we've done a deeper dig because obviously we hold both Harvey Norman and JB Hi-Fi, and so we've looked in more detail into some overseas markets to sort of see how those players have handled Amazon. We looked at comparing it to Best Buy in the US and Dixon's Carphone in the UK. And the experience of these offshore comps suggests that both JB Hi-Fi and Harvey Norman can hold sales and still earn reasonable margins after a period of adjustment. And particularly in light of the fact that we've already established Australia will be a less attractive market for Amazon compared to the US and the UK. The chart here shows that if you look through time, that JB Hi-Fi is starting from a much better position compared to where Best Buy was in terms of it having lower GP margins and lower operating costs, and they remain lower. So Although Best Buy had an adjustment period, we think JB Hi-Fi won't need as much of an adjustment because its starting position is better. The other points to note here are JB Hi-Fi recently bought The Good Guys, and Good Guys is in, obviously, appliances, and that category is far less exposed to Amazon. Similarly, for Harvey Norman, they have both furniture and white goods, which if we add it up, we think it's roughly 40-odd percent of sales. They've got their property, which is conservatively valued, and their international businesses. So the direct impact on Harvey Norman is limited to its Australian franchise business, and we think it's overstated. One other thing to back up our claims on JB Hi-Fi's low GP margin is we've sort of done a sampling of their pricing relative to Amazon's US site, and we've adjusted for both currency and GST. And when you do that, there's actually minimal differences in pricing across most categories. There were a few like AV receivers, headphones and accessories, but a lot of that difference in pricing to Amazon US is a function of suppliers charging more here. So we think there'll be a push by Amazon and the local players to get the suppliers to bring their pricing down more in line to where the US pricing is. But in fact, there's some categories such as gaming where JB Hi-Fi is consistently 10% cheaper than Amazon. So But you won't see that in any of the press. It'll all be about how Amazon are going to slash prices here by 30% or more. So in short, we don't believe JB Hi-Fi and Harvey Norman are over-earning or gouging consumers. So we don't think they have as much to lose as Best Buy did in the US. So just wrapping this up on slide 9, as I alluded to earlier, a lot is already factored into the share prices of these stocks. So if you just look at JB Hi-Fi, Harvey Norman, Meijer and Super Retail alone, they've underperformed by up to 36% from last November, which is when these Amazon rumours first appeared. They've also sold off on concerns about housing market and consumer debt, and we actually think those are probably more important than the Amazon issue. But if you recall from our housing paper last quarter, we think housing is only modestly overvalued, and household saving rates are also high. So we don't have a bearish view on that, but we think that's probably a more relevant issue for these retailers. And so the chart here plots the free cash flow yields, which is obviously one of our main things we look at. It plots the free cash flow yields of the retailers versus the market median, Amazon and Centre Group, just as a comparison. And clearly most of the retailers are actually trading above the market median. So we think this has offered some good opportunities. We still hold JB Hi-Fi. We still hold Harvey Norman. In fact, we've added to it in the last quarter. And we still hold the supermarkets, Woolworths, Wesfarmers and Metcash. So that's our view on Amazon. I'll pass it on to Neil.
Okay, thank you, Adrian, and good morning to everyone. Thanks for dialing in. Just on to slide 11. I'm just going to take one slide to discuss the other piece in our quarterly, which is value investing within an Australian context. In our June quarterly, we've included a brief four-page paper produced by my colleague Hamish exploring value investing within an Australian context. I won't go into detail yet. Suffice to say, it does provide strong evidence to support Merlon's approach to value investing, being free cash flow to enterprise value. The above chart, which is one of the four we have in the actual paper, highlights how free cash flow approach to identifying the best investments is superior to traditional measures of value investing, such as simple PE ratios or price-to-book ratios. This analysis is based on a quant back test using known prior year data. We, as an analyst team, we expect to do better than this because we value companies based on sustainable cash flow, not last year's cash flow, and we also incorporate conviction scores as we've referenced before. We believe cash flow works better than these accounting metrics such as PE or price to book because it's less easily observable. It's more difficult for CEOs and CFOs to manipulate. For example, by excluding what they claim are one-off items but seem to reappear year after year. In the next quarterly, we'll explore why value investing, as we defined, continues to work, and we'll prove that it's not because value stocks are more risky as a group, but rather for behavioral reasons. That is, these stocks are unpopular and are often difficult to justify to clients, and that leads to behavioral bias against owning them, and therefore we believe there's opportunity to outperform by you know, selectively buying the right ones. Just moving on to slide 13 on the current fund positioning. Not a lot has changed in the last quarter. Applying our bottom-up assessment of cash flow-based value using long-term discount rates, we now see the market as 11% overvalued. That's 2% less overvalued than it was 3 months ago, given the market has pulled back a little bit. But this overvaluation is not the same across sectors. We believe resources, healthcare, property trusts, and infrastructure look the most expensive. Financials looking a little bit better after a tough quarter, but industrials still have the most upside for us. And, of course, the portfolio as a whole still has attractive upside based on our valuations. We do outline on page 19 of the quarterly what we've bought and sold in the last quarter, so I won't go through it in detail here. We invested in News Corporation for the first time, Telstra for the first time. It's a small weight, but for the first time in 4 years. A lot of our long-held concerns are now starting to be reflected in that share price for Telstra, but it's not quite at our bear case yet. We invested in Fletcher Building and reinvested in Bendigo Bank. We also topped up Navitas, Harvey Norman and Metcash. all based on our process of offering long-term upside, and they might have underperformed in the short term. We funded these investments by exiting Fairfax, quite a timely exit at $1.25 after it reached our valuation on the private equity interest. We also exited BlueScope, which we've held for many years, and there's a few other small changes highlighted in our report on page 19. On to slide 14, just on performance. This is a regular slide we've presented for a while now. The key takeout from the left-hand chart is that over 5 years, Merlon has achieved returns ahead of the market on a risk-adjusted basis before and after implementation of the hedge overlay, as shown by the two blue dots above the red line. The hedge overlay reduces the risk of the Merlon share portfolio to 70% of the market, as shown by the blue dot on the left. The key takeaway from the right-hand chart is that since July 12, if you had invested $100,000, you would have received $9,000 in income, including franking credits, for the past 5 years. But this, importantly, this has not come at the expense of capital, which has also grown over that time. The unit price is now $1.19 compared to 94 cents 5 years ago after distributing all that income. And we've also provided guidance of 0.53 cents per month for the next 12 months all the way through to June 2018, again, which is the same income rate as last year. Onto slide 15, which shows more detail behind their individual financial years that make up that scatter chart on the previous slide. The share portfolio shown in the fourth row is the foundation of the fund, and it has outperformed in five of the last 6 years with a five-year average excess return of 4.7% per annum above the market. And the June 2017 financial year was quite pleasing at 8% above the ASX 200. We then hedged 30% of the risk in the portfolio, which has obviously impacted returns with the market up more than 65% in 5 years. But it is designed to reduce risk while investors benefit from the high income paid monthly. It was a good quarter with the fund returning 1.5% compared to the market down 1.3%, largely due to the non-benchmark approach, with the major banks obviously being impacted by the levy. We can discuss that later if you like. And we're not forced to hold them. It's a non-benchmark fund. The best contributors in the quarter were Fairfax, Magellan, Boral, Flight Center, and Suncorp. The biggest detractors in the quarter were Wesfarmers, QBE, Westpac, ANZ, and Coca-Cola Amatil. So just on to the last slide, 16. We just wrap up with the differentiating features again. Focus on undervalued companies based on sustainable cash flow, which underpins the dividends. A non-benchmark approach, or just of our best ideas rather than starting with the index. And hugging the index, the risk reduction, which at some point might come into play, but it certainly is there, and it removes 30% of the market risk. And this means that your clients can benefit from the monthly income that's majority franked while taking less risk than traditional share funds and still achieving unit price growth over the medium term. So I'll leave it at that. And
thank you, Neil.
Nathan.
Thank you, Neil. Looking now to Kelly, if we've got any questions on the line.
Sure, I'll just give instructions. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question at this time, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad and wait for your name to be announced. Now pause a moment to assemble a question queue. Thank you for your patience. We've got a question from Peter Foley from Third View Financial. Please ask your question.
Yeah, g'day guys. Just taking a look at slide 13 there, and the bottom left-hand corner. Are they your sector underweights and overweights? Is that what I'm seeing there with those black lines?
Thanks, Peter. No, those are absolute weights. The bars are the absolute weights. The black line is the absolute weight had you invested in the index. So just a for reference point, just to show, I guess, how it's different. But no, they're absolute weights. It's very much a non-benchmark approach.
Okay, great. Thank you.
We've got no further questions at this time, but just a reminder, it is star followed by one.
Kelly, it's Nathan here. I might just ask a question for the guys. Just looking at the banking sector, do you still see some value in the banks, obviously considering they've been under pressure lately with the bank levy, et cetera. Your thoughts?
Okay, yes. Well, we do, as with all our investments, we do take a long-term view. We said for some time that bad debts are too low at the moment. We do factor higher bad debts into our valuation. We do factor in higher capital levels, slightly higher capital levels. There's a lot of press around that at the moment. We do factor in higher margins, which we've seen evidence of lately. And I guess what has emerged recently is probably a more bearish outlook for credit growth than possibly we had before. But banks do still, factoring all those things in the long term, they do still look better value than many other defensive sectors. Of course, the bank levy was a shock surprise to us. It's quite concerning policy and not very helpful. But the banks have proven that they are simply intermediaries and they will just pass that cost on as they have done and will continue to do. I guess the one of the consequences of that of those higher rates is a reduction in credit growth. So that does look like it's emerging as a downside risk. But we are non-benchmark. We hold two major banks at the moment. It appears on that chart that Peter referred to that we have 20% in the sector, but we hold Bendigo, Bank of Queensland, and Clydesdale at very large weights. So we have actually just under 10% in the major banks, which is two of the four major banks. We prefer the regional banks because they have less unsecured lending. They already hold more capital, and they're actually more leveraged to any pricing that has occurred and any further repricing that does occur in relation to the levy or higher capital levels. So that's in a relative sense, they're better than many other sectors, but obviously, we're continually assessing our long-term view, particularly around credit growth.
Kelly, if there's no other questions, we might bring that to an end. I'd just like to thank both Neil and Adrian again for a very comprehensive update and well done on a great effort with the fund as well. It's going fantastic. Just a reminder to everyone on the line that an email will come out following this with your CPD points, but it will also have a comprehensive quarterly report with more detail around both Amazon and value investing. So please keep an eye out for that. Thanks again for joining us today and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's teleconference. We thank you for your attendance. You may all disconnect.